Hello, the internet, and for the first time in about 11 months, this is Ian Knott, welcoming you to the Viewfinder Vikings podcast. If you listened to us before, you'll know that we aim to talk about photographic projects rather than photographic gear and what it is that you're trying to do with your pictures rather than how you set about taking them. And to that end, we try to speak to photographers that we find interesting who have either complete projects or are working on projects that we think might be inspirational in some way to you, the listener. So tonight is a good example of that. I spoke with Julian Peter, and we'll talk a little bit about how to pronounce his name properly in a little while. And we talk about projects both short and long. We talk about zines, and we talk a little bit about an interesting life story that's led to his photographic practice and the project that he's working on at the moment. So hope you enjoy it, and as usual, any feedback, do please get in touch. If you listened to the last Viewfinder Vikings podcast, you'll have heard Sven and a fellow Norwegian, Arild, and they spent the first 5 minutes explaining how to pronounce Arild for non-Norwegian speakers, because Norwegian is pretty difficult, I'd say, for anybody who isn't Norwegian. So you can begin, and maybe this can be a new feature on the podcast, that you can explain how to say your name in your native tongue rather than my Julian Peter.
Given that my name consists of two first names, mm-hmm. at least to the untrained eye, I've heard many different versions of it. Uh-huh. Sometimes flipped, so I do get called Peter. Uh-huh. At least in emails, not uh-huh. not to my face. But it's, you know, all good. But if you've ever had the chance to see my name typed out, you would have noticed that they are accents. Uh-huh. Above two letters, yep. So it's about the above the A and Julian, above the E, the first E in Peter, mm-hmm. and this leads some people to think that I'm French, and so they go into the Julien Pierre.
Oh, very good.
kind of trope, but then, you know, I explain, you know, Julian's fine. How it's actually pronounced, basically in Slovak language, so I come from Slovakia, mm-hmm. Wherever you have this accent, and we have only accents to the one direction, not like the French, uh-huh. We have a couple more above letter signs, but those are too difficult to get into.
Okay. Yeah.
But it just makes the sound longer of the uh-huh. of the letter. So it would, instead of a, it will be a, and instead of e, it will be e.
Okay.
So the way to pronounce it is Julian Peter.
Okay. So it is a soft J as well.
It is a soft J as yeah. well. Yeah.
Okay.
And the name is of Hungarian origin. Mm-hmm. So my family they come from the borderlands between Slovakia and Hungary. And that's why it looks a little bit funny, uh-huh. you know, compared to other traditional names, let's say. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you for that, for us ignorant English people.
But you know, I go by Julian, or you know, here in Germany, they also have the soft J, so it's. Yeah. It's but awesome. They put the intonation on the U, mm-hmm. instead Julia. Of the yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's Julian. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Instead of on the second part of the name.
Got it. Okay, so we'll spell it out for people later on, so they can find your website and things like that. So, yeah. Unusually for a podcast, and particularly for this podcast, we've actually met. So usually we're talking to people who we don't really know other than their kind of online presence. But you and I actually met when I was in Hungary, in Hamburg 2 years ago, more or less exactly 2 years ago.
Was it 2 years?
It was, yeah. And we had a quick wander around and visited the new opera, and
Philharmonic. Yeah,
that was it. Yeah, that was it. And had a meal surrounded by mice. I seem to remember.
Yes, quite a few.
Yeah. So the reason I invited you on, and hopefully regular listeners to the Viewfinder Vikings know that we enjoy talking to people about projects rather than gear and rather than what film stock they prefer. We like to talk to people who have interesting projects underway or have completed them, hopefully to try and inspire other people that the gear doesn't matter, and you know, it's more about what it is that you're taking pictures of. So I am aware of your latest project. I'm really keen to sort of talk about that a little bit later on. But maybe before we do that, we can talk a little bit about your photographic journey, if you want to call it that, or what's kind of brought you to where you are now. Maybe a little bit of your life history, because I know it's pretty interesting.
Well, where to start? No, photographic journey. This would have started sometime in the early 2000s, mm-hmm. On a digital camera. I know you don't talk about gear, but it was one of those old, super zoomy Olympus. Uh-huh. I have no idea what they are. With the SD cards, which were thin as paper. I don't know if you remember those.
Yeah.
And if I remember, that the lens was quite good and the zoom was quite good and the resolution was a staggering 3.1 megapixel or something like that.
Yeah.
But that was the first camera I really used in any sort of photographic way.
Mm-hmm.
And it was mostly, you know, just artistic shots. I put sepia filter over everything. Uh-huh.
And we've all been there.
Yeah. Glad those images don't exist anymore. when I really, really picked up the camera, was, I think, around 2006. And I remember my dad, he had a old plastic Fantastic sort of 1980s camera. It was, yep, a Minolta Hi-Matic GF. It was the last Hi-Matic.
Got no idea what that is.
Built in 86, something like that. And it was plastic.
Mm-hmm.
But it was always hidden in one of the drawers, and I would just take it out and play.
Mm-hmm.
But I never used it. And eventually I decided to start, you know, really using film. I have no idea why, really. But I did. And I ordered a Zenit ET,
mm-hmm,
for about 20 euros or something like that. And from a second hand, something like eBay, regional eBay.
Yep.
And it arrived and I was really happy. And, you know, it had this old musky,
mm-hmm,
smell that, yep, wouldn't leave the camera.
Uh-huh.
And the very first time I tried to rewind the film, the crank broke.
Oh, great.
The rewind crank with the entire assembly. It was still fine. You know, it's just a box with transport film. But from that moment on, I always had to go into the bathroom, into the toilet. Fortunately, we had an inside toilet at the time,
yep,
with no windows, and, you know, in the dark, just take out the whole thing, uh-huh, and just spool it back on.
I taught you a lesson early on, I imagine.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I had to do that a couple more times since.
Yeah.
even now, I can still mess it up.
Uh-huh. And why photography? Why did you feel the need to sort of record your life photographically?
Good question.
We can save it for later.
When I first started taking pictures, and maybe, you know, I can get into a little bit of my life journey, so to say.
Mm-hmm.
So my dad was in the military. He's already retired now. He was a fighter pilot. And when he stopped flying, he then transferred to the Ministry of Defense. And through that, we were sent on missions abroad. So in 2001, we went to the United States. And we were 2 years in Norfolk, Virginia. And then we came back for a bit. And on the second trip, we went to a little village called Watchfield, which is right on the border of Wiltshire and Oxfordshire.
Okay.
For a year. And there maybe the first kindling started, you know. Uh-huh. I'm sure you know yourself, since you are from England. Mm. England is packed full of beautiful, beautiful scenery and, you know, historical yep. places. So the place really breeds history.
Uh-huh.
And perhaps that's also one where I started to get more interest in history. And I believe that these two paths, like the mm. photographical and the historical, somehow became intertwined at that point. But why? Why photography? I don't know. It's I can't really write. I can't really paint. Mm-hmm. I can't draw. So you have, you know, you've been given this magical box, which you put up to your eye, and it does everything for you, uh-huh. pretty much.
So did you have cameras from when you were a child? Then through as you started your kind of your journeys around the world?
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, I remember we had boxes of old photographs at home, which I like to go through once in a while. And we took the occasional snapshots. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's still albums full of pictures at my parents' home, but I didn't really take any pictures mm-hmm. as a child. It was only later, yeah, really the early 2000s. Where I don't know if it was by my own choice or if I was delegated to being the family photographer, uh-huh. Where I started to enjoy being more behind the camera instead of in front.
Yeah.
I remember one moment where to get a shot, I lay down on the ground. And I think that might have been the moment where I started to take things more serious. Like, okay, yeah. I'm willing to get down and dirty.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, I think a lot of us can relate to that, particularly the idea of being, well, you're now the family, you're the guy with the camera, or whenever there's a family get together, everybody kind of lines up and looks at you to record it or to take the picture.
Yeah, yeah.
I think a lot of us have been there. So from the UK, where was next? And
so after the UK, back home for a little bit, and then we went on to Brussels. I was there for a year, and my parents stayed a little bit longer because of the mission. And after that, finished high school, and the adult life sort of started.
And yeah, is that when you started sailing?
Yes. So after high school, I actually went to university for a little bit, for 1 year. There was a program in English. And basically, you can sort of get from me going, you know, to one country, coming back, going to one country, going back. Mm-hmm. My education isn't all that perfect. Pretty spotty. You know, none of the systems were aligned with each other. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I would do algebra in the United States and then come back and they would be doing fractions. But English was one of the things that I could do very well. So there was a program in one of the universities for a civil engineering program in English, which I tried for a year, and then decided, okay, physics and statics and geometry is going to kill me, so I'm not going to do this anymore. And after that, I was a little bit lost, trying to figure out what I would like to do. And I applied and took some entrance exams for a translator kind of studies. What was it? It was English Arabic translation or something like that. You know, this was, what was this? 2000, just prior to 2010. So seemed like an important skill to have at that mm-hmm. time. And then another school came up, and it was the nautical school. And I applied for that as well and decided to go with the nautical studies.
Okay. And that led on eventually to getting aboard ships and seeing the world.
Yeah. So part of the studies was that you would have to go through a practical experience part, and was tough to get with Slovakia being a landlocked country, uh-huh. and no seagoing ports uh-huh. But I was lucky through some family relations and family connections to get a trainee position on board of a ocean freighter, and off I went. So that was 2011. Flew to Louisiana. Then they drove me out through the suburbs of Baton Rouge. I remember it very clearly as we were crossing an intersection, there was a police car, and the police had somebody in handcuffs across the hood. Uh-huh. And then they drove us to the... Yeah, welcome to America, basically. And then they drove me and some couple guys that were also joining at the time to this godforsaken jetty in some industrial part. And basically popped us off. It's like, okay, your boat is going to come in a bit.
Yeah.
Because the vessel I was joining was in the middle of the Mississippi River. And after a couple of minutes, there came a boat. We shuffled on with our luggage, and that was the start. Yeah.
And spent how long then at sea?
So I did 3 tours altogether as part of this practical experience. On my first vessel, I was 6 months. On my second, about 5, and the last one was about 4 months.
Uh-huh. And how much of that time are you actually at sea? So on a 6-month tour, is it the odd day that you're ashore or
not? So at sea or on shore?
So I don't know what's the ratio of at sea to on shore when you.
So I my ship was a bulk carrier, and those take about 3 to 4 days to load or discharge.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't really have much time to go ashore.
Mm-hmm.
And one could say that being at sea and between the ports is your relaxed time.
Uh-huh.
You know, of course, in port, the crew is on rotating duties, and it really depends on the type of ship, type of crew, type of port, type of cargo, however the captain likes.
Because
there's a saying at sea, captain before God.
Yeah, and he's steering. So
he is the man. He's the man. And I experienced port duties with 6 hours on, 6 hours off, or a bit more people rotating 4 hours. That was more enjoyable.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And did you have a particular route that you sort of went backwards and forwards, or did it just take you wherever?
So my first vessel was Motor Vessel Federal Lida. I don't know if she's still out there or still under the same name. She was already quite old at the time when I joined, and not of the best build quality and basically rusty all over.
Was it not terrifying? Was it not terrifying being out at sea for a guy that grew up in landlocked Slovakia?
Strangely not. I didn't get seasick, so that was one big plus. There are some guys who will be seasick all the time, doesn't matter how long they've been sailing. So for me, I was very blessed in this regard.
But you didn't know that was going to be the case, presumably.
I didn't know, no. When you're out in the ocean, it can be a pretty lonely place. I mean, the ships, they do sail in established trade routes, so...
Mm-hmm.
So there are certain routes which make sense from cost perspective, time perspective, to get from A to B. But if you're in the middle of the ocean, the closest surface or closest hard ground is about 2 to 3 kilometers below you instead of around.
No, I'd be terrified. I can't imagine, particularly, you know, that thought of being above all that water and being between you and being under all that water is just this kind of rusty old boat, hours from the nearest sort of dry land. Not something
after,
I could do.
After a while, you get accustomed to your environment. So, the ship is your home. It's this 200 piece of steel and rust that is your entire world. The 20 other guys that are there with you, those are the only people you know. So you get to know your ship, and you get to know your ship's movements and sounds and vibrations. So, the ship vibrates all the time because of the engines moving. And let's say you're just relaxing in your room, and suddenly those vibrations stop. You feel it immediately. You know something's going on. You know, engine breakdown or something like that. So you really get accustomed to the rhythm, and also about the places. Okay, going out alone to the most forward part of the ship in the middle of the night, it's not the most pleasurable of experiences. But out at sea, you sort of, you know there's nothing else there, nobody else there. And if it's not cloudy, it's not that dark at all, because you don't have any light pollution. So the amount of stars that you can see, and if there's moon, you can literally read a book, you know, in the light.
I can imagine it's beautiful. I mean, we living where we do, we get everything the Atlantic can throw at us. And, you know, the weather that we experience here is unlike anything I've known. You know, I've lived a few places around the world. I imagine if you're out in the middle of the Atlantic and subject to that weather, it must be beautiful and scary at the same time.
It's, the water has, I mean, the ocean has terrible power. Really, really. I mean, I always enjoyed being in a storm for some crazy reason. It's just you know, to experience really this power of nature. You know, the waves coming at you, and they're huge, massive. And I mean, this ship is tens of thousands of tons heavy, but there comes a wave and it will lift it up and toss it from side to side. And you, there's nothing you can do about it, you know. You're at the mercy of nature. So like these moments are enjoyed a lot, less so the other moments, you know, lack of sleep and constant fatigue.
So you were photographing during this time, weren't you? Because I remember you you once sent me a link to try and sort of thin out some of the pictures that you'd got for a project, but it was it was many thousands of pictures, I think.
I did make a ton of pictures, ton of pictures, not good pictures, but a ton.
So there's a few on the website, the Prisoners of Pride.
Yes, so project. That was my second ship, at the time called HAL Pride. It was a bit smaller. She was 143 meters long. And she was special for me in a sense that it was on her that I did a circumnavigation of the globe.
Oh, wow.
So I joined her in Singapore, and I got off in China, in Shanghai. And we did once over counterclockwise.
That's quite something, isn't it?
I mean, for me it was very special. I mean, same. It was tough work. Port stays were very, very tough. You know, you are on this 6 hour schedule, six on, six off, in the port. And within those 6 hours, you know, you want to squeeze in maybe a little bit of free time, some sleep, lunch or dinner. But it was special, you know. So from Singapore, we went over to Australia to Fremantle Esperance. That was beautiful parts of the world. I hope that I can return one day. From there, we took a course straight for Cape Town. This is the longest leg that I've ever done, from Esperance over to Three Rivers in Canada, in St. Lawrence River. That journey took a month and a half. We had two short stops, one in Cape Town to take on more fuel, about 8 hours, and then further 8 hours in Las Palmas to take on more fuel. But other than that, that was 1.5 months with the 20 guys every day, same faces.
So the thing that strikes me about the pictures, and the, I don't know, there's 15 or 20 pictures from that, from however many, what did you say, 6 months on your website. But and there's only a few that have the crew featured in those pictures, but there's a couple where the crew are all kind of sitting together, either working together or sitting together. And it you can see the kind of bond between those guys, who you were talking about how well you get to know the ship. I imagine you get to know the other people pretty well as well.
Yeah. So most of my crew, the officers, were European, so either Russian or Polish. Mm-hmm. And the crew, the ratings, you know, the people that do the work, were from the Philippines.
Yeah.
And they would speak Tagalog, of course, with each other. And after a couple of months, you sort of start to understand and pick up on the nuances. And for me, I was in a strange position on board, because I was neither Polish nor Russian. Mm-hmm. You know, I come from Slovakia. I wasn't Filipino. I wasn't an officer, because I had a training position, and I wasn't a rating.
Yeah.
So I was stuck in this kind of limbo, not fitting into any one group. You know, it's shipping is a very old industry, and there's still some customs attached to it. So we had two mess rooms, so dining rooms. Yeah.
Yeah.
And one was for the ratings, and one was for the officers.
Mm-hmm.
And the ratings, they get, you know, pots of food, and they have to serve themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Over in the officers' room, you have a steward that will serve you. Wow. And like, I was always put into this officer mess room for whatever reason. They said, like, okay, you're not a rating. But then again, I couldn't really be friends with these guys because I was an officer, and they really don't want to be friends with me.
Yeah. I guess for a young, you know, for a young guy to have those sorts of experiences, and, you know, not necessarily the experience of traveling around the world, but being in those sorts of situations that you've just described, you must have grown up pretty quick, and you must have learned lots of life's lessons quite early on, I think.
I mean, I'm really grateful for the life I've led up to now. You know, even though, you know, my education is catastrophic in the academic sense.
Yeah.
I learned a whole lot of other things instead. On board, it can get very, very lonely. I don't know about the situation right now, and even right now with COVID, I think it's even maybe worse, since these repatriation flights have been more or less on hold. But we didn't have internet on board. You know, we had one computer, which had an email client, which everybody had to share. So you had to pick a good time, usually middle of the night when nobody else was on it. And you would type your email, and then it would be put into a queue. And the queue would only be sent whenever the captain would switch on the satellite connection. Some, they would switch it on quite often because they also had their computer and their paperwork to do. Others did not. Others maybe switched it on only once a day or twice a day. And so I had one captain, I think he switched it on only twice a day. So he would switch it. I wouldn't get a reply. I would get on the computer, type up an email, which would only get sent in the afternoon, which would be too late for whoever's on the other side to reply. So they would reply only with a day delay. So next time he would switch it on, I wouldn't get a reply again.
Yeah. So it'd be days.
Days, yeah. Maybe two, three days before you get a reply.
What happened next? Where did you? I'm just. This is super interesting. I'm thinking we need to talk about photography. I'm quite happy talking about this. But
yeah. No, but like during all this time, I was taking pictures, a lot of pictures of everything. I also had film cameras with me on some of the trips, and that's where this series, this Prison of Pride, was all shot on film. I had this Minolta Hi-Matic GF with me in my pocket. It was small enough. It wasn't the same one though, because the one that was originally owned by my dad, I dropped it and it came apart. So I had a different one.
But plastic meant that it wasn't gonna rust or corrode.
But it didn't do well with the hard impact. after my third ship, and my third ship was, I would say, the toughest. So this was 2012, 2013, somewhere around that time. And I had to join the vessel in Venezuela. And this was about 1 month after the Hugo Chavez died. And that whole country wasn't doing very well under the new leadership. And that hit us hard as well. As soon as I joined, one of the cranes broke down. And we couldn't take out any of the cargo out. Mm-hmm. And we had to go to a dry dock to repair it. But in order to go into a dry dock, we had to take the cargo out. So you're sort of stuck in this loop. So what the port authorities would do, okay, you cannot work. We could work only limited. Wise, they would always kick us off and put us offshore on anchorage. And that's where we pretty much spent most of my 4 months.
Oh, no. Offshore. Just looking at the coastline.
Just looking at the coastline. Oh. And there was a big, huge billboard of Maduro. And it wasn't a nice part of Venezuela. You know, it wasn't, it's like usually these places are some far away backwater factory places. Uh-huh. And our stores were starting to go down. And then, you know, we didn't have stores, but neither the people on shore. Mm. And to get stores, you always had to communicate with the people on the shore, and so that they would go and buy something of the little which was available. And then there was a small falling out with this seller, and then he said he was never coming back again. And the Filipinos started to get very, very concerned, because they were thinking that they would have to start eating potatoes instead of rice. And then, you know, things are bad, and we didn't have a lot of water. I mean, the ship had a dehumidifier, but the ship was also almost 15 years old at the time. So the water that came out was yellow.
Oh, dear.
But, you know, that's what you have to drink. And for about a month, the water was running only for half an hour a day. So quick shower, fill up the buckets and be ready for the next day. So that wasn't fun. So after that, I said, okay, I don't think I want to continue this career anymore.
Can't think why.
And so I started to look around and at jobs on shore. And of course, if you're in the maritime industry, onshore jobs are usually in port cities. And I was lucky to find a job in Hamburg, Germany. And I moved here in summer of 2014, and I've been here ever since.
Do you miss the travel and the adventure and the water running for half an hour a day? Kind of.
It's certainly not the water half an hour a day. I love showers, and I love very hot showers. So ice cold water is not my friend.
Uh-huh. You like to choose between rice or potatoes wherever.
I prefer rice. So okay, I was also sweating at the time. It's a whole different feeling to be out on the ocean, you know.
Yeah.
It's a whole different feeling if you get to steer the ship, for example, which I had the chance to do a couple of times. It's a different way of life, I would say, but it's not for everyone, and certainly wasn't for me in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
I still have classmates from school who are still continuing.
Is it something that people do for their life, for their career, or is it a young man's sort of thing?
I think you come into it with a sense of adventure. Some people just maybe want to get away from their old life.
Mm. So still in the industry, but settled down in Hamburg.
But settled down. Yeah.
And so let's talk about photography, if anybody's still listening. So talk to me about a couple of the projects that you've done ahead of the one that we're going to talk about in a while. So I can think of two or three. So I've got your Blue Mosque zine, which I'm not sure it was a project or just kind of a one day.
It was a one day event. So I moved here in summer of 2004. At the time I was still living here alone. My girlfriend, now wife, she only came a bit later. And you know, on the weekends, I had nothing to do. And along came a day, 3rd of October, which is a German Unity Day, and which is a public holiday. So great, okay, what am I going to do? I think all of the museums are open and things like that.
Yeah.
But I found out that it's also a day when all of the mosques in Germany are open to public, as, you know, symbol of unity and integration and all of that. So I said, okay, great. I've never been to a mosque. And that day actually fell on, I think it was a, now I have no idea of the religious observations, but it fell on day when the service was held as well. So it wasn't just an event with food and some arts, but there was an actual service held. And the outsiders, the visitors, we were allowed to observe. So there's this really, really beautiful mosque on the banks of the lake here. It's not called the Blue Mosque, but it is blue. I think it was designed in the 60s. It's quite modernist looking. And so I went there, you know, didn't have anything else to do. I went there, had some food, listened to some music. You know, there were some kids were drawing and things like that. Wandered through the building. We had a little lecture on the history of the mosque and history of the congregation here. So it was a Shia mosque, a Persian mosque. And then the service started. So they kindly asked us to go up in upper level. So the middle room is circular and it has a whole another level above it. We're just there looking and observing. And, you know, I've been to a church Catholic mass a couple of times, and I was like, this looks very similar.
There's lots of kneeling down and...
Kneeling down, standing up, kneel down some more, listen to the guy up front, shaking hands, singing, praying. So, you know, for me, I was like, okay, never been to a mosque, and it's exactly the same. You know, I couldn't understand, of course, but...
Yeah, didn't you take along a really noisy camera, so you kept kind of clunking through the
service? Yes. it was some kind of off-brand SLR, but it had one of those springs mirror slabs, which is when it didn't just go like crunch, but the spring, the tone would just go continuously. So it would be like, and slowly fizzle out. And there's one shot in the zine of a man praying, and he has his hand up to his face. And I was on the balcony just above him. And, you know, all of these people, they are facing the imam, who is out of shot directly below me. So I'm like, please, don't be too loud. I don't want to get thrown out for disturbing. But, you know, I pressed the shutter and just went, ka-ting! But fortunately, nobody noticed.
Yeah. No, I enjoyed that story. And it was many years later that you actually put that out as a zine, wasn't it?
Yeah. I sat on those pictures for 5 years. And it must have been, I was probably moving apartments, and I came across those prints, because back in the day, I shot a lot of color film. And I would always give it off to the local drugstore to develop, and they always came with prints, you know, the small ones. And I thought to myself, okay, what a pity, you know, to keep them in envelopes in a box. So I started by making a mock-up of a zine where I just, you know, pasted the prints to a paper and then folded the paper, and all really, you know, DIY handmade. Then we had a chat, and you talked to me about a printing service. And I said, okay, Mixon, yes, Mixon. Please sponsor this podcast.
They're doing pretty well out of me, I think. I've sent a lot of people their way.
And I just did a limited run of those.
So we have talked a little bit about those sorts of projects on this podcast. That a zine project doesn't have to be this huge life's work or something that you agonize over. It could be something that you shot, like your example, you shot years previously, but it's a set of photos that just work together that tell a story, which might be as simple as a day out in a mosque just to have a look. People seem to say oh, well, I've got, I can't make a zine. I've not got anything interesting enough or anything. I haven't got a body of work. And, you know, a project can be an hour in a mosque just laying it out and putting it into some sort of sequence that tells a bit of a story and off you go.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's really intimidating though. You know, if you look at the zine scene, it's everything super polished and very, very professional. I mean, if I look at your zines, you know, and I compare it to my zines, I'm like, okay, what am I doing?
I thank you. But I think most of that is the printers, is credit to the printers, the value for money, maybe of somebody like Mixum is just superb. The quality of those, the printing and the paper and that sort of thing for 3 or 4 euro per copy is just crazy. And people, I think people new to it don't think, you know, think that it's going to be a lot more expensive to get results that good, if you see what I mean.
Well, if I remember my very first zine, it was basically A4 papers. It was a print taped to an A4 paper. Uh-huh. Then I scanned it or copied it. I can't remember which came first. On this really old copy machine, I was in the office. It still did like this grid raster on the pictures. So that added a little bit of a layer. Uh-huh. And then I just staple it together. Uh-huh. And that was it. And that seems to be like the way I prefer to be going, instead of, you know, really putting something out like highly polished, because, you know, first of all, for me at least, it gets a bit overwhelming. You know, you have all of these paper choices and covers and like, great, there's so many options. But I do get overwhelmed by that. So I just prefer to do it as simply as possible. And, you know, it's out there.
Yeah.
Another aspect, which I think is also maybe driving people away from zines, is that at least, you know, what I've noticed, okay, you know, you put a lot of effort, time, and of course your own money into it. But I see a lot of the zines being for sale.
Mm. Rather than traded or just sort of...
Rather than traded or just given out. And, given. You know, I've never done this for money.
Mm.
And it's, like, perfectly fine. I do understand, you know, if you, like, highly polished zine, perfect, you know. But, like, I can't charge for mine. You know? it's paper from a copy machine and two staples, you know. Uh-huh. and so for my way, at least, that's, you know, the way I prefer, is just put something together, make a couple copies, ask around, hey, do you want it? Okay, here you go. Or trade, you know.
Yeah. So the one that you were talking about, was that Maru or Maru? Or did that come later?
That came later. So before that, I did... I called it Moin, which is a greeting in Hamburg. There's no copies of that. I think I have a PDF somewhere, but I would not print it again. After that, no, I don't remember the sequence. After that, I did one where it's basically for 1 month, a couple of years ago, after I woke up from bed, I had a tripod set up in the living room with a camera and a flash. And for 1 month, or whenever the roll gave out, straight after getting up from bed, I would go in front of the camera. It was still dark. I did this in February, so it was very, very dark. And I would just take a picture of me, like portrait.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the flash, which is not a good look for anyone. and I just put those portraits on the back of an A4.
Yeah.
And then folded it so it would fit into an envelope, a long envelope. Mm-hmm. And I called that one, you can't really call it a zine, it was a pamphlet. And I called it Klopf Klopf, so knock knock. That was just my reaction to the rise of nationalism at the time, and, you know, this hate against immigration.
Mm.
basically very conceptual way of imagine that you are a foreigner in a foreign country, and it's early in the morning, and somebody knocks on your door, and then drag you out of bed. They take a picture of you for records, and then who knows what will happen. So that was the idea behind that. Then I did another one, which was experimenting with folding the paper, a single page of paper, and just fold it in a way that it would unfold. And there were only two pictures on that. And then with Maru, I wanted to go more in a free flow kind of narrative and put it in actual booklet style, you know, with staples in between, and a little bit thicker. And for Maru, I just took pictures from old pictures, 2015 pictures. Went through those, picked out the best ones, printed out in smaller version, cut them out. And I knew that the maximum I could do was, I don't know, 20 pages. Otherwise, it would be too thick and it wouldn't fold well. So those were the pages that we're working for. And then out of all of these, I don't know how many pictures I had, I picked one, which I wanted to start off with. And then I just matched the next one. And to that, I matched the next one and the next one and the next one.
And that's, if I'm not mistaken, that's a kind of Japanese technique, isn't it?
Yes. So my inspiration for zine making comes from Araki. Nobuyoshi Araki, crazy guy. I think he puts out a book every week. Still, even though he's in his 70s, 80s. And one of his, or his first, very first book, he made on a copy machine. It was a series of portraits. I think the book is called Faces of Japan or something like that. And he just printed it out and bound them together. Of course, it looks much more professional. That is my main inspiration, that how easy it is to make a zine. You know, if you have a printer, it's not the best quality, but it's out there. You know, it's, you take it away.
It's a physical thing.
It's a physical thing,
You and I have talked about this in the past, and I'm sure I've said it on this podcast, but the idea of something being out there and physical, and, you know, your zines sit on my bookshelf, and the next time I'm looking for something, I'll stumble across them, and they'll be there again, which if you're, you know, an Instagram feed, that's never going to happen. But a physical thing that's traveled across Europe to sit on my bookshelf or in a drawer somewhere, you know, will turn up one day, and I'll enjoy it over again.
Exactly.
Yeah. My copy of Maru, I dug it out when I knew we were going to be talking, and on the front it says that it's edition number 3 of 0, which I quite like.
So and Maru in Japanese is a circle, or also another word for a zero, but it's more of a circle, a perfect circle. It's what you would call the you know, like we have a dot at the end of the sentence. In Japanese you have a small circle, so that would be a maru. And I'm studying Japanese at this time,
how many languages, just out of interest?
Slovak, English, German. I can switch into Czech if I like. I could understand Polish if they speak slowly. And, you know, that doesn't count as all of these Slavic languages, but and now I'm trying Filipino. To add Japanese. Filipino, already forgotten. I would have to go on the ship again.
So is it photo box, or is it Japanese photo box, or that's your particular interest?
To be honest, I don't have many Japanese photo books. They're quite rare to get around these parts, but I do like the sensibility of Japanese photography. Seems to me, at least, it's very free, yet still not, doesn't just scratch the surface, you know. It goes deeper, but it's not constraining.
It's not, and I feel formal. Like, it's,
yeah, it's yeah. not formal. It's very, you know, what you feel in the moment kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, in Japanese photography, you the single image is not that important. Mm. It's more the flow yeah. that goes across.
And the kind of feeling when you close the book, isn't it? So when you've when you get to the end of it,
yeah,
and you close the book, then you should. I think what yeah. What you're left with is a feeling that you've kind of taken from the pictures.
Yeah. So it's the book is the final product. Hmm. The book or the magazine is the final product as a whole, instead of individual pictures. Hmm. And there's one particular movement which has been also coined by Araki, called the eye photography, shashashin, where it's your personal connection to the moment instead mm-hmm. of just recording a moment. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the times, you know, the pictures are trash, or the pictures are trash and there are pictures of trash. Uh-huh. I had one book from Daido Moriyama, one of his more modern stuff, and it was literally pictures of trash in some dirty corner. Mm. But once you start looking through the book, maybe third, fourth time, the connections start to come up. Mm.
No, it's fascinating. It seems a little bit daunting, I think, Japanese photography. If you're you know, new to it or looking at it for the first time, it can feel a little bit, because as you say, you can look through some of these books and at the odd individual image and think, well, what's all this about?
Yeah.
I think you have to kind of you have to commit to it a little bit and sort of immerse yourself in it a little bit to get anything out of it, really. And yeah. I don't pretend to have done that, but there are one or two Japanese photographers who I can kind of, you know, connect with in that way. And as I say, it's often a case of looking through the book and then reflecting on it. It's not as you say, it's not the individual image. It's not looking at a picture and thinking and appreciating that image. It's what it leaves you with and the way it makes you feel, which I think is a powerful thing with in photography generally.
Yeah, exactly.
So other projects. So you before we get to the, one we're going to talk about, we're only an hour in. Yeah. So you were doing a project on the plaques, the buildings that were rebuilt in Hamburg.
Yes. So that project actually doesn't exist anymore. But I guess that is the nature of things. You know, Hamburg as a city was heavily bombed during the Second World War. Most famously in the summer of 1943 during Operation Gomorrah. And there's one particular date where in about 40 minutes, pretty much the entire city was wiped out. It was a combination of the bombs, how they were put together, there's a whole science behind that, and the combination of a very hot summer that year that created a very strong updraft and created what we now call a firestorm. Mm-hmm. And you don't really see it on the city now. I mean, it's been 70 plus years. Mm. Of course, you know, the city went through a huge rebirth and is a huge metropole. But I started noticing on a lot of the apartment buildings, apartment blocks, was a small plaque out of red clay or brick. Mm-hmm. And it would have the city sign. Yeah. And short writing, destroyed in 1943 and rebuilt 1949, 57, 61, mm-hmm. Whatever. And that started when I actually lived in a building which had this on its entrance. I've seen it before and like, okay, yeah. I understand what this is about. But the interest began when I actually lived in one of these buildings. And then I started to notice them everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And started to make a catalog, so to say. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sitting on a bus. Well, that's not happening right now during Corona.
No.
But before, or just walking, and I would notice, I would make a screenshot of you know, of Google Maps or whatever, and I would just note down the number. I would note down the year, and I started to collect all of this data, which maybe somebody will use in the future. And I started to take pictures
mm-hmm.
of these plagues and plotting it on a map and thinking that, okay, this would be one huge project, not fully understanding the scope. So at this stage, I think I have about 500 individual addresses mm-hmm. collected. Among that, of course, are, you know, on top of that, I have about 60 addresses of bunkers and tons of addresses which I have in backup, which I haven't been able to check, but I know that something perhaps is there.
Yeah,
and each plague is one house number destroyed, and very, very often you would have an entire street of houses, and it would be plague after plague after plague.
Mm-hmm.
And if you put it on a map, then you can really visualize it, you know, the scope of destruction.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, go on.
Yeah.
No, and I just want to say that, like, after a time, I wouldn't know where to look. Because you would, these buildings are more or less all from the same period, after the war when they were rebuilt, and you know, you're just looking at the facade and it's like, okay, this is red brick, so this looks like a possible area,
mm-hmm.
And yeah, the collection grew, but the collection outgrew the photographic collection. I did take a couple of pictures, but it was just too big of a project.
Uh-huh. So you didn't have an end point in sight to it, really?
There wasn't any. I don't think there would be any, yeah.
Uh-huh. And did that somehow lead on to what you're working on at the moment?
Yes. So there's a part of the city next to the part where I live which had quite a lot of these plagues. And so I was interested if any of these plagues are within my part, my neighborhood. So I contacted one of the local historical groups and just asked him, like, hey, do you know if there's any plagues? I'm doing this project. I'm mapping everything out. And they mentioned only one. And when I checked it out, it was already covered by, I don't know, additional
plastic
cladding. Yeah. So it doesn't exist anymore, at least not visible from the street. And they pointed me to a book which they've published about local history. And it was a collection of stories they've published over the past 10 years and came out a couple of years back. So I'm like, okay, where can I get this? And they point me, okay, you can go buy it there and there. So I went, got the book, and I'm reading, and it starts with the old history and how this was a small village and how it grew and then got connected and all of that. And then came a chapter about the war. And there was a story about a Avro Lancaster bomber that was shot down over Hamburg, and that the airplane crashed in my neighborhood, only a couple of streets away,
mm-hmm.
and about the fate of the crew. And that got me really interested into this particular story. So through the destroyed, rebuilt plagues, I moved completely to a different story, still connected to the war,
mm-hmm.
but in a totally different direction.
And it seems that story has taken you in all sorts of directions since that first article that you read.
Yeah. Maybe because it was of my weird childhood, or I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure I read children's book when I was a small child, but the most clear memory I have that I was reading the books from my dad's library, and he had a lot of books about the air war during the Second World War. Him being a pilot, mm-hmm. I think this was a big interest to him. And I would spend hours and hours just reading those books, or not really reading, but looking at the pictures. So somehow, you know, I have this connection. Mm-hmm. And I started, you know, I read the story. It was very short, couple of pages. And basically what happened, there was this airplane, crew of seven. Six of them were Australian and one was British. And unfortunately, they got shut down over Hamburg at the end of the war. It was the 31st of March, 1945. And from that initial story, basically, it went along the way of two of the crew managed to bail out and the rest perished in the crash. Mm-hmm. And of the two, one was captured and made prisoner of war. And actually, this article didn't really specify what happened after that. And the other was also captured, but seems by a completely different group of people. Mm. And he was marched off and unfortunately summarily executed shortly after.
Mm-hmm. And he was a really young guy, wasn't he, as well?
He was a really young guy, yeah.
Wrong side of the world.
They were all in their, well, the English guy, he was 33, he was the oldest flight engineer. Australians, they didn't have any flight engineers that could operate those beautiful Merlin engines on the Lancaster. And the rest, the pilot was 22, and all of the rest, they were just 20.
It's such a powerful story, and seeing some of the things that you've unearthed as you've investigated it. So you've posted some of the documents that you've discovered and some of the research that you've done on Instagram. And it seems to have taken you, there seems, you know, that two page initial story that you read has resulted in hundreds of pages of documents. And I'm really interested how you're going to take this, how you're going to do anything with this photographically.
Yeah. Yeah. So I read the story maybe a year, 2 years, I'm not sure, I can't remember. But then I read it again and again, and maybe it's because I was somehow always drawn to it and I wanted to know more, not just what was written in this initial one. And then a couple months back, I started to really dig into it. And fortunately, we live in an internet age where you can Google pretty much anything and everyone. And yeah, I started typing in the names and trying to get more and more, and found out that there's some information on the internet, but not a whole lot. Mm. And yeah, basically started collecting information that way. And anytime I would stumble on a particular avenue to go next, I thought to myself, okay, I will go to that avenue and I will investigate until the end. And that's how I managed then to locate a number of documents in the National Archives of Australia, National Archives in London. There's a wonderful website called Trove, which is a collection of newspapers and magazines published in Australia. And it the search engine, it will pick out certain words from those articles that are scanned there. Of course, it's now been, you know, 76 years after the fact. So many, many documents have been made public. And yeah, just collecting and researching and trying to put together a picture of what actually happened and how it happened and what happened before. reached out to a number of people, and you know, for example, I was able to find out the school this young gentleman went to. I should mention his name. So he was a flight sergeant, Kevin George Clark, and wrote to them and asking if they could help me in any way. And you know, they were very, very helpful, and they actually found a picture of him, a class picture, prior enlisting. So it's been an all-consuming project, so to say. And there's still tons and tons of documents to go through. So I've just about finished all of what was available from the National Archives. You know, you have the operational records, listing out the operations and all of the comments from the crews when they come back. And you know, that's just one part of it, the one side of it. And you know, you look at what actually did happen, because you know, they fly over target, drop the bombs, they're in and out in a couple of minutes. Usually those operations were flown at night, so can't really see anything. You know, there was a statement from the crew member that did indeed survive, and yeah, he was captured, made prisoner of war, and did actually return back to Australia. And right now, I have about 200 pages of the war crimes transcript. So after the war and after the British occupation, and they did manage to catch the perpetrators and put them to trial, and was able to obtain those transcripts. And going through those, unfortunately, they mostly are handwritten. In 1946 cursive. So it's difficult to read, but not impossible.
And where do you think this project will take you? What do you think you'll do with it?
I definitely want to put it out in a photographic way. You know, like I mentioned, I cannot draw, I cannot really write or things like that. So making pictures is probably the easiest way, or at least the most comfortable way for me to tell the story in its entirety. I don't really know exactly how it will look. I just sort of have an idea what I wanted to look. It definitely needs to be in a physical form, so like a book or a zine.
And has that kind of end result changed as you've discovered more and more information as you've got deeper into it?
Not really. It always, the end result was always a physical manifestation of the story. Let's put it that way, in pictures. I just don't know how they will look.
I'm trying to think of some examples of projects, any kind of similar projects, and I can't think of many. I've got one that's rattling around that I'm trying to think of, that was an unsolved murder investigation in Iceland. I don't know if it rings any bells for you. And somebody went and photographed bits of the scene and included in the book, in the photo book, kind of bits, copies and statements and as much as they could share of the original police investigation into it. I can't think who made it, and I'll look it up after this. And but that mixture of kind of contemporary pictures and documents, along with photos from the scene or photos present day, and maybe I don't know, reflecting the result of those actions, how they manifest themselves today, and what you can see as a result. I think it's. It could be a fascinating project. I think as we alluded to, you've now discovered so much information that it's going to be almost difficult to try and condense that into something you can
and
execute.
You also have to remember that you know, these were real people. So I would want to, you know, like I say, okay, just, you know, slap some prints on an A4 paper printer and put some staples. I don't think it's going to cut it for this. It has to be perfect. You know? Mm. It has to be perfect in order to be dignified, I think. Mm. And I talked to one person. He's actually a historian for the squadron, and he put out his own book, and then talked to me. He's like, "Be careful how you put it. You know, you don't, even though you know it's been so long, and these are deep wounds." Mm. So.
Yeah, and there's still a family.
There's still
families on the ends of these.
Yeah, I mean, it's a horrible, horrible thing that had happened. So that's not going to change. But you know, how do you tell that story that still is respectfully, you know, respectful? Mm-hmm. And I don't want to pick any sides. You know, was this bad or was this good? You know, you could argue the coin from both sides and until end of times. For me, it's a very personal project, and kind of goes along with this, you know, eye photography, which I mentioned before. It has to make sense for me. I think it's a way of dealing, or not dealing, you know, but it's a way of understanding it for me. Mm. So even if it doesn't ever come to light, public light, uh-huh. it's fine as long as it's, you know.
Yeah, you've scratched the itch sort of thing. You've done what you needed to do with it.
Yeah.
So, do you give yourself a deadline for this, or because you know you could potentially spend an awful long time on it?
It's awful lot. So I haven't gone through all of the documents and the nature of the events. It's not exactly 100% clear. Mm. I don't think we'll ever be clear. You know, I have to look at it from context. You know, it was the end of the war, and things were kind of muddy, and it has been 76 years. Mm. But I would like to at least have a first version, let's say, done this year. So so as I've been going through documents, and you know, I've been always thinking about, okay, how do you tell the story visually? You know, I think you mentioned it, like I could talk about this for hours and go into every detail, make a movie out of it, or you know, an audio podcast. But how do you tell the story in I don't know, 20 pictures, let's say. Yeah,
it's going to be really interesting to look on from a distance and see how you go on with it. No, fascinating. Thank you for telling us about it. As I say, anybody who follows you on Instagram or has spoken to you, they'll realize the just the amount of information that you're unearthing. And as I said earlier, this kind of avenues that it's taken you along that may have been unexpected from where you started.
Mm. You know, the crash site, the crash site, it's only a few streets away, and I do go past it very, very often, always thinking of those guys. And there's nothing there to mark it, you know. So I think if we are talking about like an end goal, a small kind of memorial would probably be the end goal.
Mm. Fascinating. Thank you, as I say, for talking us through it. Anything else that you've got going on? It sounds like that's all consuming at the moment.
That's pretty much all consuming. With family and job and. Yeah. You only have so many hours in the day, so I do this usually, you know, in the odd minutes in between or at night.
What you need is a few months on a ship, maybe, where you've got time.
If it had a stable internet connection, yes. so it's with the lockdown and not going out and about, and even if I'm going to the city, it's pretty much empty. And I don't mean in a bad way. Like, I do not take pictures at the moment, not a lot. And that's fine. Mm-hmm. For people that are struggling, it's okay. I would like to say it's okay.
Yeah. There are a lot of people struggling with that they feel the need to output stuff.
No.
And you don't, there's no
you
rush.
Don't. No, no.
it can be difficult to realize that.
Yeah. I mean, I look at it in the same way with me trying to learn the new languages. Like, if my mind is occupied with this topic for about 10 to 20 minutes a day, then that's totally fine. You know, if I spend 20 minutes talking or thinking about photography a day, but you have to do it every day, totally fine. Doesn't mean you have to go and, you know, take tons of pictures. Yeah. So no, like, I don't have anything going on at the moment. I mean, I'm very, very bad at posting. I don't post anything. So there's a huge archive over the years of pictures and negatives which haven't seen the light of day. I have one big batch of pictures which I took with a camera which had a date imprint. I wanted to do it before it would revert back to the 80s. I think 2020 was the last thing it could do. And it died on me in the middle of the year.
Oh no.
But I said, okay, I have these pictures, and let's see, maybe something will come off those. Maybe I'll put it together, you know, slap some A4s together. But it was just fun, you know. It doesn't have to be serious. Like, this project, yeah, this is very serious, and I'm taking my time, and I want to do it properly.
Yeah, yeah, it certainly feels like it deserves it. Thank you. That was that's going to be. I find it fascinating, and hopefully other people will take something from it and think about the range of projects that you've talked about there, from an hour in a mosque through to something that's taken you months of research before you even take a picture. That's a good example of the sort of what photography can offer people. That, you know, it can be everything in between those things. And a project, as I said, doesn't need to be a life's work. It can be as simple or as complex as you wish.
Yeah, yeah. No pressure.
Yeah. So if people want to keep track of your progress on the project and anything else you're putting out, where do they look?
So I am on Twitter and Instagram at JULOPETR. So Julo Peter. And if you'd add at .com at the end of that, you'll be linked to my page, to the website.
Perfect.
Which hasn't been updated and touched in years and years.
Yeah, but people can have a look at those pictures from the sea that I was talking about earlier.
Yeah, yeah,
and yeah, catch up. Okay, great. I always ask people, is there anything I should have asked you about that I didn't?
I don't know.
Did we miss a big chunk of your life, or your first Pulitzer Prize? Do we miss that?
I have a feeling we talk more on non-photography related topics than on photography related topics.
That's fine. People can put this onto 2x speed and fly through it for the interested bits.
Skip to the last 10 minutes. I mean, that's photography for me. It's like breathing air. I can't go without it, and it's intrinsically entwined with living. And so those cannot be separated. You cannot really, you know, separate those two out. And yeah, like I said, if, you know, sometimes you have good days, sometimes you have bad days. Just, you know, continue having fun. You know, remember. Especially, you know, in this day and age, remember why you picked up the camera in the first place.
And that there's no pressure. There's nobody.
And there's no pressure.
Unless it's your livelihood, which is
unless
which
your
few,
livelihood,
few of
yeah.
us, I guess. But
yeah.
It shouldn't be another pressure, because everybody's got enough pressure on them at the moment.
At the moment, yeah.
Okay, I'm not sure that's a very upbeat way to say goodbye to everybody. You got any jokes? No, that's been fantastic. Thank you. I'll drop some links in the show notes, whatever they are. I hear other people on podcasts say, "Oh yeah, it's in the show notes," and I guess that's the little bit that you kind of write when you post the episode. But yeah, I'll
and that nobody's going to read.
Well, hey. Both the listeners might click onto your website and take a look, because I'm sure we've sold it. So yeah, thank you one more time, and we'll speak again soon.
Thank you for having me. It was a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you.